This afternoon I'd like to speak about freedom within the freedom of God. And I do so because from my own experience, it has been freedom that has led me to Jesus as Lord. And in saying this, I have to recognize that it isn't an easy route, because freedom always implies freedom from as well as freedom to. And so many of us have to keep running pretty hard before eventually we are caught up by the hound of heaven. And I think it is that somehow or other, the Christian church in many of its forms and guises, and maybe because of its limitation of the faith, of the gospel, to too narrow a view, has lost the whole sense of human freedom that is God's gift to man. A freedom that is not centered upon politics, not centered upon economics, but that is centered upon God himself. As I say, that it was freedom that led me to Jesus and Lord, and that my hallelujah of faith has been hammered out on the anvil of doubt, as Dostoevsky said so well. After I left high school, I thought maybe there might be something to this God business, and maybe something to this man Jesus, and maybe something to the gospel, so that when I went to university, I went to what was supposed to be the most Christian group on campus, who made a great deal of fuss and were very noisy in their declaration of Christianity. And I found it a very disappointing experience. I found those people who claimed to be such glorious Christians to be rather very narrow, to be very angry with everyone, to be very judgmental, very condemnatory, very critical. And more than that, actually, they were life-denying rather than life-affirming. Rather than upholding the glorious liberty of the children of God, they were speaking all the time in terms of dreary negatives. You know, don't smoke, don't drink, don't dance, don't kiss the lassies. And if you don't do that, what's left? So after a time, I sort of realized that if this was the gospel, it simply wasn't good news at all. It was bad news. It was news of sin. It was news of human defeat and human failure, and news of the impossibility of God to do any better. And so, as I became a philosopher, I chose the road of reason and argued to myself, well, at least that perhaps by means of intellectual concepts I might be able to make some kind of sense of the world. And so it seemed to me, in a very rational basis, the obvious thing to do in order to improve the condition of the world was to join the master clan of planners and become a politician. And so I set out to do that. And indeed, I was appointed to the colonial service of His Majesty's government as Assistant District Commissioner in Malaya in 1939. Unfortunately, I saw the war clouds dark on the horizon, and I said, well, Malaya's a silly place to go when the war is obviously going to be in Europe, and that is where I ought to be. So I did not accept the commission that was given to me, and I, who had been a former officer in the Royal Air Force, switched from the Air Force because of an accident I'd had, and entered into the army as an infantry commander. And then war came, sure enough, and I went to France and North Africa, and then to Malaya. And one of the things that I learned about war was the fact that it's no good. And it's a simple lesson, but a very important one. The only people who talk about the glory of war, the only people who talk about honor and peace through war are the politicians. But once you've been in action in the front line, and remember that the number of men in the front line in any army is very small. And generally we don't hear about them because there are very few of them return. I was in France, and of those who were with me in France, there was only a handful. I was in North Africa, and of those who survived in North Africa, there was only a handful. I was in Malaya, and out of those who survived out of a battalion of over 1,200, including our first line reinforcements, there were only about 200 survived. And I think we don't hear very much from the warriors because very few of them return to tell the truth. And those who do return to tell the truth aren't warmly received by the politicians who continue to speak about war and honor and glory and profits. And so very naturally, you become cynical. What else can you do? Because remember, actually, that a country makes impossible demands of its warriors. It demands that you give your whole life to and for your country, your whole time. In six and a half years of service, I never had a break. And I worked usually about 6 or 7 days a week, and very often day in and day out. And when we were in action, we'd fight for day 5 days at a time. I was wounded twice, and I was captured by the Japanese. So by the time I was captured, I was rather cynical. I was cynical of the great statements made by politicians. I realized that so much of my fighting had not been for freedom, had not been for a land that I could possess, but had been for tin and rubber and profits and profiteers. And when I came back, I discovered that there were an awful lot of people who were sorry that the war had ended, because they had been making an awful lot of money out of it. But anyway, that is illustrative, as you can see, of the kind of cynicism that a warrior develops, and who can blame him. So by the time I was captured, I'd cut out my rationalism. I saw that rationalism was inadequate. I saw that you cannot solve the problems of the world by purely rationalist means. I saw that the ideology, the political ideologies, are a hoax and a form of enslavement. I saw that freedom is not political. And that's a very small freedom. That freedom is not economic. That is a very small freedom that can very easily become a tyranny. I learned something else, and I'll go on to talk to you about that. And one of the best places to learn about freedom is in prison. And as you know so well, that some of the best documents on freedom that have ever been written have been written from prisons. And some of the great Christians who have come down the line and who have dared to write about freedom have written from prison. And remember that those who signed the Barman Declaration of 1934, what was it, 300 reformed ministers signed. You know about the Barman Confession, don't you? Wasn't it about 300 or was it 200 reformed ministers and some Lutheran ministers signed the confession, the Barman Statement of 1934, to the effect that they would have no Lord but Jesus, people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Niemöller and hundreds of others that we've forgotten. And those men, remember, said that our freedom doesn't lie within the state. It doesn't lie within the political system. It doesn't lie within the economic system. Our freedom is with Jesus, who is the Lord and giver of all honest and real freedom. And as a consequence, most of them, you remember, spent their lives, the next 8 years, in prisons, and many of them, indeed most of them, were executed for that freedom which they upheld against the freedom of tyrants and Caesars and political ideologies. And so prison, therefore, is one of the great laboratories of freedom. And one of the things that I learned as a prisoner of war, that the conditions of which we were most conscious in prison camp are simply the same conditions that we experience within so-called civilization. When my book, Through the Valley of the Quiet, came out in 1961, it was extremely well reviewed, particularly by the secular magazines, if rather poorly by the church magazines. And one of the magazines that gave it a splendid review was the Book of the Month Club magazine. And the Book of the Month had chosen it as an alternate choice and gave it a splendid review. And at the end, it said, there's only one disharmonious note in this book, and that's contained in the last chapter. Because when this man, Ernest Gordon, came back from prison camp to Western civilization, he was unduly critical of Western civilization. And we feel that having been a prisoner of war, he should have been much more grateful. Now, one of the reasons, there were many reasons I wrote the book, and I haven't told you all of them, and I won't tell you either tonight, today. But one of the reasons I did write the book was to show that all of us are imprisoned. All of us are in captivity. I wrote that book to show that the prison camp wasn't out there in the jungle of Thailand or wherever it might have been, but that the prison camp is where we are, and we all have to find our freedom within whatever situation we might happen to be. Well, the first form of captivity, the confinement that we experienced very naturally, was the captivity of the man-made prison camp. It was simply made of bamboo and a barbed wire with a deep ditch about 6 feet deep, enfiladed by machine guns, with a moving group of sentries and then sentries within that group. And so to all intents and purposes, it was a situation of maximum confinement, maximum security. All you had to do was to look out of place and you were shot. And yet nevertheless, several of us repeatedly broke out of prison camp and came back in again. And that sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? If you're in prison camp and you get out, why go back in again? For the very good reason that there was another form of captivity even greater than that of man-made captivity. And I'll tell you about that in my next point. But at this point, regarding man-made captivity, remember that this is what civilization is. If you read the story of civilization in the Bible from the time of the fall, and the fall of the Tower of Babel, read it in the Psalms, read the story of the fall of Satan, Lucifer, you will find actually that the Bible speaks with a great note of criticism about civilizations. Why? Because civilizations put themselves in the place of God and demand from people a loyalty that only God can demand of his people. And so very quickly, therefore, we learned that our freedom is not within civilization nor within the structures of the state. Secondly, as I say, that there was another form of captivity greater than the captivity of the man-made prison camp. What was that? Hmm?
the surroundings, right, the surroundings where we were in the jungle. How many of you have taken a walk in the jungle? Well, you know what it's like. You know that the three forms of jungle, primary jungle with the trees as high, what is 200 feet, secondary jungle whereby acts of God, whether by fire, lightning, earthquake, storm, the trees have been knocked down. Then you get dense undergrowth forming, and through that grow the great trees. And then the third form of jungle, which is, of course, the bamboo jungle. So that in order to escape, all one had to do was to make one's way through 1,000 miles of those three kinds of jungle, which apparently in our situation was impossible because no one made it. 50 of my friends attempted it, and all of them were executed. The only other alternative in, by the way of escape, was to make your way through the jungles, over the hills for about 250 miles, and then swim the Indian Ocean for about 800, 900, 1,000 miles. And if you passed the sharks, you made either Ceylon or India, and there is no record of anyone having tried that. And so there we learned, you see, that the natural habitat is much more confining than we are taught at school and by other people. And we're only beginning to learn that. That the only way that you can live with your natural habitat is in love, is in reverence, is with care. And now that we've corrupted the land, polluted the land, the waters and our resources, we have to go back to the Bible and learn how it means to live with some degree of freedom in the neighborhoods that God has given us. Well, there were still other forms of confinement. And there was the confinement of time. Now, remember, actually, that time is created along with space. It is one aspect of creation. And that slave time, or enslaving time, is that time in which you have no freedom for yourself. In the one part of the wisdom of the Old Testament was the realization that man could have one day in the week for himself if he had one day for God. And the whole law of the Sabbath was a law for the protection of human freedom, so that one day in the week men were freed from the controls of civilization, the controls of the state, the controls of their business, the controls of their bosses, whoever they might be. They were free to find their freedom within the freedom of God, and that day was a symbol of that. But when you work 7 days a week, 12, 14, 16, 18 hours a day, you begin to lose all sense of identity. Your personality begins to disintegrate. And particularly when you've done a long day's work and you come back, and no sooner are you back than you're called out for a roll call. You go and you lie down and you've just nodded off to sleep, and another roll call and another search. And all the time you're under the control of a time that is no longer yours. It is the time in the hands of the captor, who uses the control of time to destroy the authentic human life of each individual that he seeks to control. And it was in those days that I looked back wistfully to the so-called drab Sunday experiences of Scotland. And just before the war, a Sunday experience for me went going to the university chapel in the morning, and we went there because it was a communal experience. Whatever it was a communal experience in which we were free to see one another and to be with one another. And and as a consequence of that, after the university chapel, we'd meet with each other, maybe go to lunch, and then arrange to have a walk in the afternoon and so on. And those dreary Sunday afternoons seemed to me to be divine by comparison with what we experienced. I simply mention this to illustrate again the reality of this enslavement of time, and we are all subject to that kind of enslavement.
And what are some other forms of enslavement? Well, surely there is the enslavement of attitudes. What are the seven deadly vices if not forms of enslavement? Let me give you an example of what I mean by this. When you've come through action, and when you've been a frontline soldier, when you've been wounded, and you know the cynicism of politicians, when you know that your whole cause has been a write-off and you've been thrown away by political action, you can't take it easily. And so you tend to become what? You become cynical. You become bitter. You become hard. You become good at hating, because you feel that the whole world is against you and there is no place for you in this world that is controlled by the so-called power elite. You're nothing but a cog in a machine. And that's what we discovered. And I discovered actually that men who gave themselves over to hatred became so bitter that that hatred, that bitterness, destroyed them. We discovered that fear destroyed a human being. Because some of our young men, remember that some of our young prisoners of war were only 16, 17, 18, and 19. They'd come straight from high school. They'd come straight from their apprenticeships and been thrust into the hell of jungle fighting. And they had been subject to fear so strong, so enslaving, so destructive, that the soul within them had been destroyed. And that's when I realized that Jesus was right when he said, "Don't be afraid of those who can kill the body. Be afraid of those who can kill the soul." Because we saw these poor souls coming back with nothing in their eyes but an emptiness, a hollowness. They had been destroyed, and those were the most pitiful victims of war. And so we learned that these attitudes we possess can be awfully destructive. And some of the goals upheld by society are the very goals that reinforce those destructive qualities. I'm trying not to be too cynical. And so I won't go on any further and tell you some of the truth. And so I'll go on to speak about another form of confinement. The form of confinement that all of us must face at some time or another, and that is the reality of the confinement of death. All of us are in the room of no exit. We are in the death cell. We're all going to die. Some of us will die fairly soon, and some of us will die in a few years' time, or 20 years' time, or 30 years' time, but we're all subject to the natural law of death. And that's what happened to me. Like everybody else, I had to work, and I had to work with malaria and dysentery and beriberi, and I'd had appendicitis, and I'd had my inside ravaged by worms and ulcers and other things like that. And then I had diphtheria, and I still had to work with diphtheria. The first thing that I knew that I'd had it was when my throat began to clog up, and I came back one day and borrowed a piece of mirror and looked in and saw this great big chunk of yellow phlegm at the back of my throat. So I got a nail from somewhere, rusty old nail, and scraped away at it. It was a great big chunk of heavy phlegm flecked with blood, if anyone wants a clinical description. And so I scraped away at this with my rusty old nail until I performed an operation on myself and got rid of it. And I thought, now I'm in the clear, now I'm free. Now everything's all right. But within a few days, my palate fell. That is, I was paralyzed in this T-zone area that you read about, you hear about in mass advertising. And I couldn't drink, couldn't eat. Every time I took a drink of water, every time I took some rice, it would come
pouring out of my nose, and that wasn't very pleasant. But I kept on working, getting weaker and weaker. And then the next thing that happened was that I was paralyzed from the waist down, and the Japanese very rightly decided that as I couldn't walk, I couldn't work, and so I was put into the hospital, which was nothing but a death cell. It was a death house. The very moment I was put in, I was carried in and laid down, and just as I lay there, hopeless and helpless, the man next to me flicked up in a sitting position and fell back with his mouth wide open. And no sooner had he fallen back than there were about 1,000 flies swarming around his mouth. I'm not afraid of hell, because I went through it. And I can think of no worse hell than that death house. And the stench of dysentery, the stench of gangrene, the stench above all of bed bugs in the millions, so weak were we, and so filthy were our surroundings, that the bed bugs came out in their millions and literally, almost anyway, carried us away. And we were covered with bites from head to toe. And if we tried to brush them off, then the smell from those bloated bed bugs was indescribable. And I can think of no worse hell, really, than that. And that's why when those who talk about hell don't frighten me. Because I've seen it all, and I can't think of anything worse than that which we experienced. Well, so there I was, like all of us, in the death house. So the question, therefore, is, how did I get out of it? How did I get out of the death house? And the answer is exactly the same as that which is given in the New Testament, that which indeed is the gospel, is that somebody came in and took me out. This man was Tom Rigdon. He was a naval officer. He was much older than I. And what had happened after the fall of the last command I had had, I who had been commissioned in the Navy and the Army, failed to gain a commission in the Navy. Although I'd sailed all my life, I was born on an island. And whereas people nowadays have motorbikes and motor cars, all I had were sailing boats. And I spent all my life sailing and being with fishermen and being a seaman and all that sort of thing. And I couldn't make the Navy because I hadn't gone to an English public school. And so I didn't make the Navy until just before the fall of Singapore. And the general had suggested to the Navy that they hand over whatever ships they were leaving behind. So they were leaving behind 3 gunboats which came under my command. And so with my little division, I went into action against the Japanese, but by the time I came out, the fighting was all over, and I made my way to Sumatra in this little gunboat. And on the way, I picked up the survivors of a ship of the Royal Navy that had been destroyed by enemy action, and among those, the captain was this man, Tom Rigdon. So we went over to Sumatra and organized an escape service. I went on to try another escape in a little sailing boat in the Indian Ocean, and he stayed behind. But for some reason or other, he was concerned about me. And although the last time we had met was that time when I took off for my little jaunt in the Indian Ocean. But whenever he came in to a new prison camp, he would say, "Does anyone here know Ernest Gordon?" And so he came into this prison camp of Chung Kai, and he asked the question that he'd been asking all along. And he said, "Does anyone know Ernest Gordon?" And somebody said, "Yes, I do. Where is he? He's in the death house. What's he doing there? Why, dying, of course." It's pretty obvious. And so he came down to visit me. He came into the death house and he looked around, couldn't see me. And no wonder he couldn't see me. For one thing, my beard was big and black and thick. And for another, that was about all there was of me. In those days, I could put my hands around my waist. You know, sort of changed, haven't I? And he came in and he couldn't see me. And I couldn't speak. And I could hardly move.
And he went up and down looking, and he was just about to leave when he saw my arm wiggling, and he came and he said, "Good God, it can't be you." And I nodded to say, "Indeed, it can, and it is." And he was so moved by compassion, and he had heard actually that the death sentence had been pronounced upon me by the doctors who said that I was going to die, that he arranged with a couple of my men to have a little shack built for me against one of the main huts, a shack about so high, so that I could die with some degree of dignity. And that's as much as I knew about his story. I knew that he was responsible for taking me out. I knew that he was responsible for organizing these two men to nurse me. But it was only about 6 or 7 years ago that I learned that he had done a great deal more than this, and I've written about this in my book, Meet Me at the Door. What he had done, actually, was to sell his gold Rolex watch, everything that he had, his greatest treasure, a treasure of infinite value in that particular situation, in order that one of my doctor friends could buy through the black market and through the few Christians in that area, the food, the emetine, essential for the cure of amoebic dysentery. Because it was the theory of the doctor that the only way I could possibly recover was by having this amoebic dysentery cured. I was losing blood at the rate of every half hour. And with the blood and the ulcerated intestines, there was the loss of food. And so I was getting thinner and thinner until I reached the stage when I couldn't even put my hands around my waist because my hands weren't strong enough to do that. And so I was carried out and nursed back to health. But I didn't know that Tom Rigdon had risked his life in order to give me that advantage, in order that I might live. And that, if that isn't example, as my friend told me, of greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for a friend, I don't know what is. And so what happened to me, as what happens to all Christians, is that life was given to me. It was not my own by right of possession. It was given to me by the sacrifice of those men who enacted the gospel. And so the problem that I've been left with ever since: what do you do with a life that's been given to you? Now, this is the problem for every Christian in the whole of the Christian church. Unfortunately, I think it is a problem that few people realize. What do we do with a life that God in Jesus Christ gives us? And so let me demonstrate the reality of the gospel at work, of how the gospel is enacted. The gospel isn't a theory. The gospel isn't an abstraction. The gospel is God at work. The gospel is grace. And what is grace but God's loving presence? And so as I'd come through the death house into the new experience of life, so had my own particular camp at Chung Kai as a whole. It had been known as the death camp, and that death camp was transformed by the action of present, active, living grace into a camp of life. And miracles happened. Now, miracles, I don't think, happen in the way that people think they should happen. We've been brought up to believe that miracles should happen as a form of magic. You know, if you're out of money, you pray for $100 bills and suddenly put your hand in the pocket and there is $100 bill, and there are some so-called Christian folk who are daft enough to think that's the way it happens. It doesn't matter how much we prayed for bread. No bread, brother, was going to drop out of the sky. It didn't matter how much we prayed for medicines. No medicine was going to drop out of the sky. No matter how much freedom we prayed for, no freedom was going to drop out of the sky. Well, then, in what way did miracles happen? Because, as I've just said, miracles did happen.
Well, the first miracle that happened was that we became conscious of God's presence in our midst. And the church became the living center of that death camp that became a life camp. And what was the church? But simply the community of ordinary men who found that the center of life was not in themselves, but that center was in Jesus Christ as the Lord of life, the Lord of creation, and the head and heart of the church. And that was the first miracle, and a very beautiful miracle it was. I began my ministry. I was called into the ministry at that time, and in those days I'd preached to a congregation of 2,000 men. No wonder I was spoiled. Imagine starting off your ministry with a congregation of over 2,000 caring, attentive men. And it was a very beautiful experience. And one of the most beautiful experiences that I can remember among many was the admission by the right hand of fellowship and the confession of faith of two Chinese. These were men who had been picked up after one of the massacres of the Chinese in Singapore. As our troops on the way to prison camp had passed the scene of massacre, someone saw a movement. And so he went down and they discovered a man who was wounded but alive and was likely to live. And they found another one, and they took both of those back, gave them British names and numbers and uniforms, and although they could speak but very little English, and the British soldiers could speak but very little Chinese or no Chinese at all, they found their freedom, they found their identity, they found that saving knowledge of themselves within the community of faith in which there are no racial or economic or political divisions. And it was a great joy to see these men come into the body of Christ's church because the faithfulness of some of Christ's people in that situation. And from there we moved out. And the first healing miracles that happened not in a sensational way, but in a very natural way. Some of my friends formed a blood team. That is, they went around, and when a man was very, very ill and was dying, they'd go around and find someone who was strong enough to stand up, and they'd drag him along and siphon off a pint of blood, maybe a pint of blood from someone else. And then when the other guy who had given his blood became weak, and he was on the verge of dying, he'd get a transfusion from someone else. And so in this way, the delicate balance of physical life was preserved. And if that wasn't a miracle, I don't know what was. Another miracle was that I became involved in massage. And I found actually by the healing touch, there was also the healing presence. And I have cited examples in my book, Through the Valley, of men who were paralyzed and who would have remained paralyzed if we hadn't got up off our fannies and massaged their wasted and dying and almost dead legs so that they came back to life and they were able to walk. Another man was so... This is a very interesting situation. This man was so motivated by compassion that he felt for the hurts of all his comrades. And this was a man who had graduated from the lower school at the age of about 14 or 15 in Liverpool, gone to work in a pharmaceutical firm. And then in this prison camp, he'd been very concerned about his comrades. And so by the use of his mind, by thinking things through, he was able to create from living bacteria medicine that was very helpful in the preservation of life. But not only that, he created an anesthetic from some of the alkalis in the plants in the jungle. He, with a 9th or 8th grade education, was able to work miracles of a very natural way
Because what? Because he cared. And the greatest miracle of all, remember, is the miracle of love. But a greater, an equally great miracle was that this man went back to England, went to Cambridge University, and although he's about 10 or 11 or 12 years older than the rest of the people in Cambridge or in his class at that time, he graduated with first-class honors in his field of chemistry, and within a few years became, strangely enough, one of the youngest members of the Royal Society. He was made a fellow of the Royal Society because he had discovered ways of separating living bacteria. And he had thought about this in prison camp when he was inventing medicines. So with his eighth grade education, he'd been able to reach that point so that when he went to the big university, he was able to use the resources and the techniques of that university to put into practical effect that of which he'd already thought about at a previous time. Well, this again is simply an example of what I mean by a miracle in my terms. Other miracles were the formation of a university, the formation of a symphony orchestra, the formation of drama groups, art groups, all kinds of groups. Groups that affirmed life because they were conscious of that the Lord of life was in their midst. As I said, I became involved in ministry at that time. I'd been rather cool and aloof and indeed bitter because I saw all my chances of glory being flushed down the John. And we didn't have any Johns, we'd only boreholes. But whatever it was, my chances of glory were being flushed down because I'd had great expectation of the services. After all, I'd been through the whole thing, and I'd been given an appointment to the Army War College, and if the damned Japs hadn't come, I'd have been able to go to the War College and ended up the war at least as a brigadier. And then I probably would have gone on in the profession of the military, but that didn't happen. It didn't happen. And so what did happen was that one day, while I was recovering from a paralysis, two or three Australian soldiers came to us and they said, "We want you to come and tell us about Christianity." And I said, "Why come to me? I might come and tell you everything that's wrong about Christianity." And they said, "We don't care. We want what's fair dinkum." And those of you who can speak Australian know that fair dinkum means straight and true and honest. And if Christianity is not fair dinkum, well, then we want to know about that. We want to know the facts. We want to know the truth. I said, "All right, I'll come, but why'd you ask me?" "Because you know I'm not particularly Christian or anything like that." "Well," they said, "we know that you've been at university, and we know you're a fighting soldier, so we know you'll give us the fair dinkum." So I said, "Fair enough," and I went. And it was from them I learned about the gospel. It was through them I saw the gospel in action. It was by their concerted love and the love of those men who'd almost laid down their lives for me that I was dragged protestingly into the dimension of grace. Those of you who remember that great fifth chapter of Romans will remember that we are justified by faith. And to be justified by faith simply means that God in Christ stands beside you as your justifier. He is the one who comes to you and says, "This beat up old wreck of a soldier who has done all sorts of terrible things and including the taking of the lives of other people, this man I claim for myself. I am his justifier. I will put things to right." And that's what justification means. And we found that by faith God justified us. We didn't justify God. God justified us. But something happens as a consequence of justification. What is that? What is that? It isn't the end of the Christian life, it's only the beginning. Because as Paul tells us in that fifth chapter,
chapter, that by justification we enter into the dimension of God's grace. Our life is now lived in the grace of God. And what is the grace of God but the freedom of God, the love of God that sets us free and calls us into that freedom in which we find our true freedom. And the evidence of hope, as Paul tells us in that great passage, which is so badly described and preached about, the evidence of our hope is in our endurance. It's in the endurance of faith, in the endurance within the dimension of grace, the endurance of suffering, that we have the confidence of that hope, which is the appropriation of the ultimate good that God has already expressed in the life of his Son, Jesus. And one of the things that we learned in that situation was that God was indeed present with us and that he was present in our suffering. We were heretical, really, by the orthodoxy of the church, because we believed that God was present in our suffering just as he was present in the suffering of his Son. That was the same sort of experience that Woodbine Willie, Studdard Kennedy, had discovered in World War I. And he wrote of it in these great words, "Only in him can I find home to hide me. Only in him can I find strength to fight. Only in him can I find strength to overcome the evils of the situation in which one finds oneself." So it is in that way that we find our freedom, our authentic freedom within the freedom of God, and that freedom is known within the suffering that we share, the suffering that we bear, the caring that makes such suffering and such a sharing possible. And so our experience of freedom was therefore that our true freedom is within the freedom of God, because God in Christ calls us into a relationship with himself. He doesn't force us. He doesn't come and say, "Well, look here, you're damned, and there's no hope for you. So unless you come, you'll be damned." He comes to us and he says, "I love you." And he says, "Your life is fulfilled in my love. And my love is the evidence of my freedom, of that freedom into which I now call you here and now." And so that's why I've been trying to speak and say a little bit of something about our freedom as being within the freedom of God. This is the transcendent freedom that makes all our little freedoms become possible. And so it was on this note of Christian freedom that I have tried to build my theology or my Christian way of thinking. But I mustn't hold you here within the thraldom of time. But if anyone have comments or criticisms to make, I'd be glad to hear of them. All right. We'll let you go. Yes?
I have one. How did the Japanese let you conduct?
Well, I can't tell the whole story. And as a matter of fact, actually, the Japanese became very aware of the fact that it was this religious, this faith dimension that was making an enormous difference in our lives. The Japanese, you see, at the fall of Singapore, had declared publicly that they would bring the white man to his knees. They'd done the same thing, I believe, in the Philippines as they did in Malaya and Singapore and Hong Kong. And here, to their astonishment, actually, as things got worse, and they deliberately made them worse, that this hadn't happened. That men had not been defeated by their circumstances. And they realized rightly that one of the forces at work in this renewal of life was the Christian faith. And so in February of 1945, services were forbidden. So we went underground. We became the underground church from then on. And it was very interesting in my book I tell, I think one of the great examples of the freedom into which we had entered was when we were making our last march, which was to a punishment camp. We didn't know it at that time, but we learned afterwards we were to be executed, and we were to be executed on the 28th of August, but the end of the war came on the 15th of August, so we didn't have too much to spare. But anyway, as we were coming along, we entered into this clearing in the jungle. And there we saw a series of railroad trucks that had been shunted off, filled with Japanese wounded. Now, the Japanese, because of their Bushido doctrine and all the rest of it, and simply because of the Oriental attitude, as far as I can make out, have no concern about individual human life. And so what happened was, when men were wounded, if there was an empty carriage going along, they'd be allowed to ride in it. But whenever it had to be filled up with troops or supplies, they were emptied out. And here they were left stranded. And here I was in command of a company of British officers, and they're no more snobbish, prideful, privilege-conscious people in the world, probably, than British officers. And all my work had been with the Jocks and with the Australians and people like that and with the English Tommies. And I wasn't sure whether the Christian message had come through. And that's when I learned that it had, because as soon as we came into that clearing and that group of about 150 officers on the way, remember, to a punishment camp saw the Japanese wounded, without thinking, without batting an eyelid, all of them moved out, and I had to follow behind them. And all of them moved and took out a man, found a man, cleaned his wounds, cleaned his filth, and shared what they had with them. And they hadn't much. They had a little water in the water bottles. They had about a handful of rice, which was to last them for 3 days. And this they shared with them. And that was when I realized that it is by the power of divine grace in our own lives, in which God brings us into his freedom, which is the freedom expressed by love, that you no longer have enemies. You know, when you find your neighbor, when your enemy becomes your neighbor, it's no longer your enemy, is he? And I think it's very difficult to learn that very important lesson, but we learned that, and that was when I became conscious that even those who had been most privileged, they too had entered into the freedom of God. Yes? Yes, well, remember, actually, 9 years of my life was spent in the forces. And the forces, you know, speak the language of Galilee. It's not the language of the drawing room. And so I found that if I were to communicate with men, that I had to speak as one of them. I had to speak their language. And in my books have been severely criticized. Any Southern Baptists here? I have been severely criticized by the Southern Baptists, and indeed a very splendid novel, Solon, has been put out of commission by the action of the Southern Baptist book rooms. I wrote this book, actually, to demonstrate the reality of the gospel in the midst of a sinful world. And if you try to make sinful men into saints, you're lying. And I think that's what some so-called Christians want to do. And that's why, actually, that I choose to use rough language, if you will, just as Jesus chose to use rough language, the language of the Galileans. And don't let's be prissy. That's one of the awful things I found in coming back. It's an awful shock to come back to the established church. It's made up of of old women and old men who should have been old women. You know? It really was an awful shock. I mean, you come back out of an actual situation where love is the dominant power. And you don't sit in judgment on one another. When you sit down beside another man, he's your brother. Your beloved brother. You don't judge him. You embrace him. And if he speaks rough language, you don't mind. Because you know there's something bigger than that, something better than that. And we came back and everybody was being so prissy. And they expected us to conform to the standards that they upheld. And that's why when we came back to civilization, we found that we'd come back to a new form of captivity. One of the first things that happened when we came into Liverpool was that there was a strike underway. And as soon as we were to dock, the strike was to take place. And so a group of my men came up, and I'd been a sailor, but not, in a military sense, not been in the Royal Navy, not having gone to public school, simply to Scottish schools. They said, let's work the docks. And that's something, that's one of the great things about the Scottish infantry, the Highland infantry, you can do anything. And so I said, all right, we'll do it. And this group of men who had worked with me in the past in the socks, in the docks of Singapore just before we went off on a little battle trip, said, let's work the docks. So I went up to the harbour master in all of my innocence and said, I've got a group of my chums here and we'll work the docks for you. He said, oh, good God, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. The national strike on our hands if you do this. You can't do it. It's impossible. But I said, all we want to do, actually, is to get food for the people. You know, the rations in Britain weren't awfully good at that time. There were nectar as far as the food of the gods, as far as we concerned, after what we were through. But for the average person, it was pretty poor. And I said, we'll work the docks. You can't do it. And we pleaded, and there was nothing we could do. There would have been a national strike, which had called out the army, the police, and everybody else. And you found yourself once again within these restrictive structures of so-called Western civilization. And I think we have to fight against them all the time. And I think one of the tasks of the church in the world is to stand for the freedom of all people. And one of the great movements, I think, that's taking place in the church, in the world, is in Africa. And I think the church in Africa today is a martyr church. Because on the one hand, you've got the emergence of cruel tyrannies. And on the other hand, you've got the emergence of a first century church. I think the kind of church that emerged in our situation in prison camp was a first century church. We're very simple in our theology, and I'm very simple in my theology to this day, because it's posited on the reality of the Lordship of Jesus Christ over every aspect of life. He is Lord over presidents and kings. He is Lord over civilizations. He is Lord over the banks and the mass media. And we are his representatives in this, the world that he loves. He loves it. And we have the task of working for God's, the freedom of God's people. It's not ours to coerce. It's not ours to intimidate. It's not ours to burn people at the stake as they did in the medieval days for the good of the souls. It is ours to offer God's freedom that the people God has chosen may indeed be truly free. And that's a great commission, isn't it? And we shouldn't be afraid of it. And it affects every aspect of our life. It affects our family life. It affects our university life. And I agree with my friend Roger over here. I think the Presbyterian Church in this country made a great mistake when they plunked for public school education. That may be a very democratic thing, but not necessarily a Christian thing, because what happened in democratic, what happens in public schools and public and state universities unless there are Christian faculty as a leavening influence, what happens at the only point of meeting is the secular. And our Christian and universities come into being, remember, because of the Christian faith. And an authentic education takes place within a community of faith. And whenever you secularize, your education and your hospitals and everything else, you've got nothing left. Then you've given the world to the devil. And Jesus doesn't want us to do that. So there's a big commission, and there's an awful lot of hard thinking to be done. And another thing, I think we have to stop thinking of ourselves as Presbyterians. I'm a bad Presbyterian.